We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and I'm here with Brian O'Connor. And Brian is attending a three-day conference in D.C. this week on meditation and its effects on people. So there are people doing research on meditation, and there's this large conference being held downtown right near the White House at the DAR Constitution Hall, and it's being presided over by the Dalai Lama. Participating in is the Dalai Lama. And so, Brian, let's talk in this segment a little about meditation first. It may stray into yoga as well, but meditation as a practice and what it does for someone in someone's life. You know, we talk in this country a lot about what religion does for people, what their faith does for them. And Buddhists don't have quite the same kind of a belief about God or the universe. You're much more on your own in Buddhism. But this notion of spiritual practices is quite important in Eastern philosophy, Eastern religions. And I don't say that Western religions like the Christian denominations don't have practices, but you don't hear of people getting up every day and going through the same ritual. Well, like prayer would be the equivalent, I suppose, and there are many similarities between prayer and meditation. But start by telling me what meditation does for you on a daily basis and what it's done for you long term.
Let me start by giving you a simple analogy. One of the things that I decided to do maybe 15 years ago was get back in a regular program of exercise. And the reason for that is I realized that I was starting to get out of shape and I was starting to lose my ability to do things I'd wanted to. My quality of life was less. So I thought, okay, I've got to re-engage training my body on a daily basis, training my muscles, redeveloping them. At the same time, I was thinking about diet and thinking, what have I got to do about how I eat and paying attention to that and getting back into that process? Part of the reason I was thinking about those things is because I had been engaged in and had been engaged in for a very long time another thing, which is training the mind. And one of the things that we don't talk about in this country at all is we don't talk about training the mind. We can train body, we can train how to eat, we can do a lot of things, but we don't talk about training the mind. We don't talk about this experience that we have that sometimes gets loose and takes off on us.
That's right. In most places we don't, but on the Andy Finn Show we do, and people that listen know that we do, and that's one of the reasons why we're talking about this stuff tonight. But I agree with you. It's an underserved area. I have this promo called Bigger Brains, and what it's a couple of women watching a guy go by with a huge brain. I said, you know, can you imagine if in the physical world, as you worked out your brain, your head actually got larger and you could actually see the brain power the way we can see the biceps, people would be out there pursuing bigger brains. And women would be coveting me and my brain, I'd like to think.
See, the interesting thing is that mind, working with the mind means, first of all, paying attention to thought and feeling. And what we're talking about here is that it's a mental training in the sense that it's not just brain, it's the whole of us. It's mind-body, but it's also recognizing that mind-body are two descriptions of the same thing. And so that what we're really working with here is the process of, first of all, just paying attention to thought, paying attention to feeling, and paying attention to our tendency to believe what we think, to believe the feelings we have, rather than just hang out with them and notice them.
Yes.
And so this is a really helpful process because you begin to take a different attitude towards your experience.
Let me stop there and bring up or tie up a couple of points. Tie together a couple of points, because you've said a lot right in there, and I'm not sure it's clear without some further exposition. So the first piece of it is that part of what meditation can do is you can empty your mind of busyness and noise, right? But what you're saying, too, is just noticing the thoughts and the feelings and everything that you have, because we tend to think that all our thoughts and all our ideas are who we are. But in fact, all of that is a type of mask or a type of noise that may keep us from getting at who we really are. And we also have in our head a lot of interpretations. You know, one of the things that I've learned as I've gotten older is most people think they have facts in their head or they have truth in their head. You hear this all the time from the 20 percenters on the far left and the far right. They talk about, this is the truth. What you're saying is not the truth. No, it's not so much about truth and lies. Mostly we have very few facts in our heads. Mostly our head is full of interpretations. And so somebody does something at work and we either take offense or we don't. One person says, how dare he do that to us? Somebody else is like, what does it matter? He's just being John. That's the way John is. But we all then relive these thoughts in our heads. And the next day, there's some people going home from work. And while they're working out on the treadmill, they're saying, John is such a jerk. John is such a jerk. I can't believe he dissed me like that. But all that is an interpretation. And so they're getting themselves all worked up on the treadmill about something. John is home having a beer and relaxing, and he's not thinking about that incident, and he's not thinking about the other person. So this is a way we torture ourselves.
Very true. And one of the things that's interesting is that there is a description in Buddhism that is helpful along these lines. There is what's called pain, and then there's what's called suffering.
Oh, I was sure you were going to say pain and gain, because I know those two.
Well, what happens in a very simple way is if you stub your toe, what happens is immediately there's physical pain. But then what very quickly comes for most of us is suffering, which is that we then get upset with ourselves or something because we're in pain. Instead of just hanging out with the physical pain and just staying with that and not doing anything more with it than just hanging out with it. Because when we take it to the next level and we start getting upset, then we add suffering. Then we just take the whole thing and make it much more intense than what it needs to be. We do that with all sorts of things.
Yeah, it strikes me there's two sides to that. One is that what you're saying is that pain, like pleasure, is simply sensation. And your brain takes it in and interprets it. So something that's really cold, something that's really warm, we put our hand and say, oh, that's nice. Unless it's a really hot day. But something that's really cold, you pull your hand out, oh, that's too, but it's really just sensation. It may not really be painful, but immediately we declare that unpleasant. So we immediately take all of our feelings and say pleasant, unpleasant, typically. When in fact, a practitioner of Eastern philosophy, a yogi, sees it all as just sensation and gets a burst from any of it because it is just bodily sensations.
It's sensation and it's also information. Because you can think of pain as being something that says, hey, I want your attention. There's something here that's been injured, so you need to attend to this, and that's the whole point of the message. That's the point of the signal that says pain. And so if it hurts, fine, it hurts, but that's all it has to be, and then you attend to it. It's an invitation to go to it.
Right, and the other part you're saying, the suffering that we add to it is the story. It's the interpretation that says, oh, I can't believe I was so stupid that I put my hand on that hot burner. And now I've got a burn, and now it's going to keep me from writing tomorrow, and this thing's going to be painful. I wonder if I should see a doctor. And we get all this stuff going in our head when, in fact, if you just put some ice on it and go on and do something else, you're ahead of the game.
And the meditation process actually starts to burn out those thoughts so that after a while you don't have as many of them. And part of what happens in meditation is you notice the tendency, the habits of doing those kinds of things, that each one of us has our own habits. And so what we're doing in meditation is paying attention to how we do that, how we create the suffering. Not that we can then turn it off, because the thing is it keeps coming back up again. But as it keeps coming up, we become less reactive to it. We give it less energy over time.
And I think by suffering, you mean more than just the pain you may feel after a burn or something, or the remorse you may feel for how it happened. But we have suffering at an emotional level from all kinds of things, not just from physical pain. Right? You're talking about meditation as an antidote to the suffering we feel when we come home and say, oh, this didn't go right at work today, and oh, I'm worried about tomorrow, and oh, I wonder if the kids will call, you know, and whatever else it is. But we have, all of that is suffering.
And if you think about depression as being what happened and anxiety being about what's going to happen, then meditation practice is about what's right in this moment. And in this moment, there is none of that. But what happens is that we very often leave and go someplace else and we're not home.
Yeah, and I think that is another place where we want to spend a couple of minutes here, because the other piece that strikes me about meditation is that you really, the goal is to be present. That is, so much time in life we do spend worrying about the past or thinking about the future, And I suppose it was John Lennon who said, life is what's happening while you're making other plans. But the basic principle here from Eastern traditions is that the whole idea is to live in the present. Baba Ram Dass wrote that book back in the 60s that we all read called Be Here Now. And
he still has one now, which is called Still Here.
Yeah, I think you told me that. The other thing is that I was just at a contest, a Toastmasters contest, which is a table topic, and they give you the topic at the spur of the moment, and they ask you to expound on it for 2 minutes without any preparation. And the one they used for this contest, I wasn't in the contest, I was in a different contest, but the one they used was a quote from Shakespeare, and it says, to be or not to be, that is the question. And they said, what does that mean? And for me, what it means is actually being present in your life, being present in the moment, in a conversation with somebody else, and not just sleepwalking through life as we tend to do a good part of our day, where we walk into the Starbucks to get the coffee and we don't really pay attention to people, and we put the order into the person and we say, hi, how you doing? But we don't really stop and focus on that person, and we don't really mean hi, how you're doing, typically. But being present is changing that and saying, okay, I'm actually going to have an authentic hi, how you doing with this person at Starbucks. I'm going to look them in the eye, and you will, if you approach it right, you often get an authentic reaction.
The challenge is to be able to do that, and so that it's like, what do I do to get a practice so that I'm more able to do that over time? And I've been a great proponent of front porches, because the thing is that there used to be, in the country we live in, a lot more front porches. Well, what did people do on front porches? They used to sit there, and neighbors used to pop by for no particular reason. They used to let the world go by. There was a quality of being there. There was nothing to do. And so since we've given up front porches, I think we've got to start meditating, because we've got no other place to be.
But I think your point is that what meditation can help you do, if you do it on a daily basis, is empty out all the noise and all the concerns and all that little voice in the back of our heads that has us worrying about tomorrow already, and we haven't even started enjoying tonight. And it allows you then to quiet the mind, if that's the goal, or to focus the mind, if that's the goal, and then to actually be present to whatever sensations you're having in your body, whatever thoughts you're having, but to let those go and just say, okay, those thoughts are there, those sensations are there, and allow you to focus on just the on life and on the present moment.
The first step in meditation, in Tibetan meditation, is called shamatha, and shamatha means calm abiding. So the first goal in the practice...
Calm abiding?
Calm abiding.
Calm abiding.
So the first goal is to work with calm abiding, which means if you're sitting still, you're working with just allowing yourself to come into that experience of just being there, and then noticing when you leave and coming back, noticing when you leave and coming back, and being okay with that, because that's what is. And over time, that begins to change.
So if someone were to start a meditation practice, what would you recommend, first of all, for the length of time? If they were going to do it, let's say, 5 days a week or every other day for a while. I mean, ideally, they do it every day, but for some Americans, that's not realistic.
I think that every day makes sense. And I think you can find 10 minutes in a day to do that.
Yes.
And usually what happens is that it is easier for people to do in the morning, because as their day gets going, that's the easiest thing to just let go of.
Plus, that 10 minutes could help you later in the day.
It could make a big difference.
And then what would be the first type of meditation you recommend someone try? I've heard before that a breathing practice, that is, just breathe deep in and out and just focus on your breath as a way to let other stuff go. Because as soon as you start thinking about your thoughts and saying, oh, I don't want to have thoughts, you start having thoughts about it.
The thing is that you want to begin by sitting straight up in a chair. And the reason for that is that if your spine is straight, you're much more likely to be present. You're much more likely to be able to come back to awareness of just this present experience. And you relax your shoulders, and your head is sitting above your neck, but it isn't in a military style. It's still somewhat relaxed, but there still is a sense of presence that's in a straight-up way. And your eyes are not closed, but they're open, but not to anything. They're just there, present to whatever the experience is right in front of you. There's the sounds around you. There is the physical experience of being there. And as you breathe, you just let that breath be whatever the breath is. It doesn't have to be deep. It can be just whatever it is. On its own, it will get deeper. And so what you're doing is just attending to the out-breath. And it's like strange because how do I not notice the in-breath can often be somebody's feeling. Well, you'll notice that too. But the intention is just to stay with the out-breath. And every time you notice that you've gone off, you just come back. And it's okay to go off because you're beginning to learn how your unique mind works. And that's really the practice. The first practice is just really getting to know your mind better than you ever have before and how it does what it does.
Okay, well, Brian, thanks for being here. And the Andy Finn Show will be back after this.